Welcome to the Social Exchange Podcast. My name is Zach Rhodes. This is episode number 71. Today's guest is my friend Eric White. Eric White is the creator and the host of the EW Podcast. Eric doesn't podcast just to be a sage on the stage, if you will, but he does it so that he can have valuable conversations with people who interest him and can bring value to a greater audience. And that's something that we have in common. You know, I have a podcast because I like to have these kinds of intellectual conversations. I like to dig a little bit deep. I like to ask questions that are tough, that on a daily grind when you try to have these conversations with people, it's not socially cohesive, let's say, to ask probing questions or try to get into deeper truth. It's just not practical. So podcasting is a good outlet for that. Eric and I today talk about his backstory, including a bout of depression and even some suicidal thoughts and how he recovered from that. Then we discuss what it means to find purpose and meaning in life, which is what he says got him to the place that he is now and away from depression and suicidal ideation. And we talk about how one even goes about finding purpose and meaning. Finally, we have a meta conversation about podcasting, why we do it, why it brings us value, and how having interesting and even difficult discussions, A, makes us better people, and B, empowers the people in our circles of influence to be better people. So enjoy this conversation, please, with my friend and yours, Mr. Eric White. I'm with Eric White. Eric, thank you so much for coming back on.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Zach. It's a pleasure, man.
I felt like it was such a treat to have you only on a podcast because the conversation went really well. People, before they're hearing this or seeing this, will be able to hear our initial conversation, which I edited down a little bit to keep the salient parts and talk about who you are. But this, in earnest, is, I'd like to call this the official episode with Eric.
All right, cool. I'm on board, man. I enjoyed the first conversation, and yeah, I appreciate you wanting to do this again, to have the video.
You're the host of the EW Podcast, which I've been on, had the pleasure to be on. And you and I met, of course, as part of the Unity Movement. So I'd like to start there. What is the EW Podcast, and how did it come to be? How'd you get into podcasting or putting ideas out there?
Yeah, so I guess you could trace that back to even college. I was a journalism major, so I've always had an interest in storytelling and being, you know, creative outputs. I never used my journalism major after college, really. I ran a little blog, but I never really was interviewing people or anything like that. My work has taken me in other directions. But yeah, I went through an experience of being depressed for about almost 10 years. And there were really bad moments in there of attempting to take my own life even. And coming out of that, which I eventually did through the several events, several things, you know, a loving community, which is something we've talked about, a psilocybin trip, and a lot of therapy, kind of all came together to help me get out of that funk. And as I got out of it, I was like, oh man, I wonder how many other people are going through something similar and don't know how to get out of it. I also was genuinely curious about the mind and how it was possible for me to be in a state where, you know, I've said before that it was like my world was desaturated, like it was black and white, and coming out of it, you know, colors were more vibrant, life seemed more vibrant and vivid, and it was a total shift in just my perspective of the world. And that, so there was some genuine curiosity on my part of wanting to learn more about the mind and talk to people who know more about this stuff. And also at the time I was really interested in podcasting. I just, you know, I think in the last 10 years as well, that's become kind of a medium that is really accessible for listeners, just because you can, you know, obviously do it while you're working, while you're doing the dishes, whatever, and being able to have those free flowing conversations, it can be really fun. So I figured, why not put these things together and start my own podcast and, you know, push myself in that way.
So when you were a journalism major, did you do that because you had a general interest in seeking information, delivering information?
Yeah. So, I mean, my interest at the time was sports. So my dream was to be a sports broadcast journalist. And halfway through college, I kind of, I got diverted from that typical journalism sequence and got involved in advertising, which in the school was in this school of journalism. So I was still taking journalism classes. My focus was more in advertising and, you know, project management, coming up with creative and things like that. I think the interest has always been just about stories and wanting, I don't know, there's a little bit too there of wanting to be seen, which I think is something that, I don't know if you can relate to or not, but you know, I think especially when I was depressed, which I was in college, there was a belief that being known or being seen would be a way for me to feel better. Like I felt as though there was, a respect or love from other people that I wasn't getting that I needed to get through being on TV or being heard. So there was a little bit of that, but also a genuine interest in stories.
You mentioned this last time we talked about wanting to be seen, and I've been thinking on it now, and you asked me if I could relate. Don't remember what I said, but if I said no, I'm wrong, because to some extent I never want to be seen. But the truth is, I want to be acknowledged and seen at my best and like never seen at my worst. That's a fault of, you know, a flaw of mine. And I'm coming to grips with that. Like, just the more I try to be authentic, the more I could be okay with people seeing me fuck up or, you know, whatever, say the wrong thing or not say something elaborately enough. And so I'm coming to grips with that. And I'm curious if that's something similar for you.
Yeah, it's actually interesting, and maybe you can relate to this with your own experience dealing with heroin and now, you know, talking about topics related to that in terms of addiction. And I think when I was depressed, there was a desire to only be seen at my best. But I think as I've come out of that, one, my desire to be famous has not evaporated, but it's become way smaller. Like I don't feel the same way about being known as I did then. And I also respect the value of my worst more now than I did then when I was my worst. Like I think now I look at those worst moments as being the things that make me relatable to other people. And I view it as something that is good and should be talked about.
So. Nice. So when, let's see. It seems like the story in my mind, and so please feel free to push back, don't let me write it for you, is that you kind of you were on a trend of being a journalistic kind of a person and getting things out there, maybe being seen more often, but that was stymied by an overall depression or lack of connection or lack of connection with people and meaning in life. Mm-hmm. What, if that's, to the extent that's true, and correct me if I'm wrong, how old were you around that time that you felt like going on a downward trend?
So it really became noticeable to me. I mean, it really started in 2006. Was kind of the emergence of this depression. But I think it really peaked for me in my junior year of college. So 2006, I would have been a sophomore in high school. It was my junior year of college. What is that, 5 years later, where it started to peak for me. And I think from that point on, about 2011 to 2014 was kind of the worst for me. And that was a period where my depression had gotten so bad and I had become kind of so accustomed to the worst parts of it that I, in fact, viewed it as the thing that made me unique. And so I was simultaneously dealing with these self-destructive patterns of thought and behaviors that were holding me back from doing the things I wanted to do, but I was simultaneously romanticizing them and believed that, you know, binge drinking alone and being mad when I woke up, I believed that these things were the things that made me unique and would eventually help me be known. So it was it's a weird thing to think about.
So you're a junior in college. Did you finish college?
Yeah. Yep.
And the standard track?
Yeah. Yep. Yep. 4 years. Yep. Coasted through the last year, but made it.
Understood. Don't ask me how I know, man. But, and so into young adulthood, you were feeling sort of
isolated, I guess would be the word, sort of romanticizing the destructiveness of it, but feeling isolated all the while.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And I did it to myself in a way. I moved out to San Diego after graduating college in Ohio, and I bought a one-way ticket actually the summer before my senior year. So I went through my whole senior year knowing I would be leaving the East Coast and coming West. I didn't bother looking for a job or trying to find a place to live or making friends. So I came out to San Diego with nothing. I was literally alone in that sense. And I was so depressed. I didn't have any motivation to find new people. So it was an extremely solitary period of my life for sure. Mm-hmm.
And so how did you build yourself? Well, we'll get to the good stuff, like, you know, sort of triumphantness and psychedelics and everything that you do now. But I mean, how did you put yourself together with, you didn't have a job and you didn't know people and you're just kind of there.
Yeah. Yeah. I was
Take just me through that.
Yeah. So I remember I landed in San Diego and I had booked a hotel for, I don't know if you're familiar with the area, but for in El Cajon, which is east of the major part of San Diego. Mm-hmm. And I remember I was so naive, dude. I like had a bunch of resumes printed out and I was like, I'm going to walk to all these places, hand deliver my resume, show what I'm made of in person. And I remember the first day I was here, I ended up walking like 15 miles or something just around town. Didn't end up giving my resume anywhere, just ended up walking all around town trying to find these newspapers in places where I thought I was going to just storm in and win everyone's hearts and minds. And that didn't pan out. So I eventually had to go for a job at Best Buy, which I'm lucky I got. And I also found another job doing some travel editing for a Las Vegas website. So I had these two jobs, found an apartment on Craigslist, and thought things would get better.
So you got some gigs. So wait, hold on. You walked for 15 miles. Why didn't you get to the places that you were going to drop your application off?
So I got to one, and I thought that I would be, I had maybe 10 or 15 copies of my resume, you know, in a folder, really nice, printed out, ready to go. I made it to one. I think I made it to the San Diego Tribune, but I was just so disorganized in my thinking. I didn't really have a good plan of attack. I just kind of had this dream of pushing the doors open and everyone being like, oh, wow, who is that guy? Meanwhile, I'm like dripping sweat. You know, if I had walked in someplace, I mean, I did walk into the San Diego Tribune and I was just dripping sweat profusely. They're probably like, oh my God, this guy's a nut. So, yeah.
This might be off target, but do you feel like you would be doing stuff that you're doing now if you didn't have that experience of trying those things?
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know. I would like to think that I would have eventually gotten here, but then it's, you know, it's impossible for me to even conceptualize
Yep.
getting to this point without experiencing everything that I
have. You've experienced. Yeah. I guess the way I was taking it is that, you know, it's all nice and fanciful and cute to say stuff like, you know, failures lead to success or whatever. But I have noticed that when I've dreamed big and then I go to actually do the practical thing that I was dreaming about, and I realized that there were, you know, 10, 20 infinite more steps to it and hurdles than I thought, I've formed a better relationship with reality because of that. That's where my mind immediately went. It's like you had big dreams of doing stuff in journalism and working for all these places, but you realized that you were leaving something out in the vision, I guess. You're leaving little.
Yeah, no, thoughts. That's a great, that's a really good way of looking at it. It kind of, it's, you know, a harsh encounter with reality can make you reassess your thoughts on reality for sure. And I think that's a great way of putting it. Yeah.
So how did you get from where you were just kind of getting by your living? But you mentioned having sort of an eventual uptick in happiness and mm-hmm. just productivity overall.
Yeah. How did I get there?
Yeah. What's the transition look like without?
Yeah.
Like you said, we don't have to think about every event that led you there.
No. It's, I mean, there's clearly a series of events that happened. So in college, I had started, my friends in college were very much into video production. They started a video production company while we were juniors, I believe. And they were my drinking buddies, my best friends, friends I still talk to today, and I'm very close with. But I had no video experience at the time. And I spent a lot of time watching one friend in particular. He goes by Ted Cadillac, shout out to him. I spent a lot of time over at his place watching him edit. We would just grab 40s and sit and edit videos, and I would just be sitting there watching.
Insert a picture of Ted with a 40 right there and his yeah. Instagram handle. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I would sit there just watching him do this and becoming very interested in how he could take a bunch of otherwise ambiguous footage and turn it into something, a narrative, and set to music. That was something I was really interested in. And so when I was alone in San Diego, one good thing that happened to me was my cousin, his name is, he goes by Grinchero. He's a musician. At that time he went by Grinchero. Now he's Hazel Atlas. He moved out here to San Diego to be with me, and he was playing music. And I started shooting videos of him doing music things and developed my skills for shooting and editing. And fast forward probably 2 years or so, and I'm in LA now, and I'm working with a rapper named Chubby Jag on creating video content for him. He was a battle rapper turned a hip hop artist, I guess, who is really good. And we worked together on these weekly videos called Flat Top Fridays. So I was, you know, honing my skills more and more there. And that led me to eventually working with this group of DJs known as Desert Hearts, and they have a music festival and record label which has blown up quite big, and they were gracious enough to give me the opportunity to film their parties from early on meeting them. So basically, my video skills allowed me to come to this community called Desert Hearts, which was eventually the main catalyst for me figuring out that how I was feeling was not normal. I met my current girlfriend through that group. And I think we might have talked about this in the audio version of being in close proximity with people who were very happy and who loved each other very unconditionally.
Yeah.
And so seeing that and being close with that on a very regular basis, I had some sort of osmosis go on where I was like, I need to figure my shit out. So that was the main catalyst.
So did you know before that you were depressed? Or do you feel like you were being delusional? Or like you only know you're depressed in retrospect?
Yeah. I mean, I knew I was depressed once I started to realize that these things were not normal, but going through it alone in San Diego, like I said, I had romanticized it to the point where I thought it was a good thing. And I had no comparison point from my experience to another people. I wasn't open about what I was experiencing with anybody. I never talked to anybody about it. You know, I've talked to my college and high school friends since all my peak recovery, I guess you would say. And they had none of them had any idea that anything was wrong. You know, it was very easy for me to be the happy-go-lucky one around them while carrying this burden in my personal time. And so there was never anyone that was saying, yo, Eric, that's not normal. You know, what you're experiencing, it's not normal to wake up and feel like that. It's not normal to be so angry at yourself. So it was totally a thing in that I didn't realize I was going through until I was almost out of it. Yeah.
So I guess what you realized was how much potential there was to just be feeling better.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. That's a great way to put it. I realized that, I fully realized that the romanticized version of myself was not the best version of myself that I had, decided to allow actions to manifest within my day-to-day that were actually holding me back from, you know, experiencing close relationships, from experiencing joys in life. Like it was really a crazy moment to look back on, for sure.
You know that we don't run ads on this podcast, and we're never going to. Instead, I'm going to give a shout out to some of my favorite local businesses in Vermont, where I live, and I'm going to do that throughout the year in light of the difficulties that they faced during the coronavirus pandemic and beyond. I hope that some of my Vermont listeners will turn your attention to these businesses and consider taking your business to them. And when my out-of-state and international listeners are finally able to come to Vermont and enjoy everything it has to offer, I know that you'll check out these businesses as well. This month, I'm giving my shout-out to Union Jacks. What is Union Jacks, you ask? Well, imagine that you walk into an Arby's, and then you order a sandwich. And then you think, wow, this is not the kind of sandwich I want to be associating with. Certainly not the environment in which I'd like to be eating it. And look at the people who work here. Do they even care about my satisfaction and well-being? Union Jacks is your answer to all those problems. It's run by a family originally from the UK, and they're famous not only for their sandwiches, but for their authentic British-style fish and chips. Union Jacks is located on Route 7 in Burlington, Vermont. If you have a hankering for a sandwich or fish and chips, especially if you were thinking about setting foot in an Arby's, think again. Consider visiting my friends at Union Jacks in Burlington. You're not going to be disappointed with the food or the quality customer service, and I'll bet you leave never realizing the customer service could have been so great at a fast food restaurant in the first place. Remember, Union Jacks, Burlington, Vermont. Now back to the show.
Let's talk about that psychedelic experience. You did touch on it when we talked in the audio podcast, but yeah, so that's all standalone.
Yeah, for sure. So I think it was 2014 or 15. It was at the Desert Hearts Festival, which I mentioned just now, which is a pretty crazy festival. It's three straight, they start on Friday and it goes till Monday and the music never stops. It's just one stage. There's like 3,000 to 4,000 people there. And I was in charge of the video crew, doing the festival recap. And I think it was on a Sunday. I would usually take a day off to just enjoy the festival and try to not stress about the video, because at a festival where the music never stops, it's hard to stop your anxiety or your feeling of you have to be in control. So I took a day off. I ate some mushrooms, and I was just standing on stage listening to the music. And as the mushrooms kind of took hold, I started to revisit all of the things I had been talking about in therapy, revisit conversations that I had had with my mom. And in literally an instant, I became overwhelmed with a sense of empathy for my mom, who maybe we can get into to help this stand alone. But we had some events occur around 2006, kind of the inflection point for me, where our relationship completely changed. And her love for me was in a way withheld as a result of some things that we were dealing with. And so in that psilocybin trip, I fully became empathetic to the things that she was going through. And it gave me this release of being able to forgive her for anything that had happened, which was a really transformative process for me, and something that I don't think would have been possible had I not been doing the other work around that. And I think, going to therapy twice a month definitely played a huge part in me being able to access this sort of perspective on the mushrooms. So that was, yeah.
Would your mom agree? I think we actually broached this. Would your mom agree that there was love being withheld from her to you?
I think I don't know if we actually talked about this. So we did talk about how we disagree about what happened, but I think that she would agree that in ways her love was withheld from me. Actually, I know she would. Yeah, she would agree with that, because I know she would. There was things that she did that she has apologized for that were not okay to do to a developing human, I don't think. And she's also apologized because she, which is, I don't know, maybe an arbitrary thing, but she decided to go to get her doctorate at the same time that I was in college. So she was never really there for me in a meaningful way during college. She was always wrapped up in her own things. And I actually, yes, to answer your question, I do think she would agree with that.
Was it that, and sorry, I don't mean for this to be like a psychoanal, you know,
analysis. No, I'm down, man. I like this. Yeah.
Was
turn
it
the that, tables on you.
Was it that, that she couldn't put the energy into sufficiently being there for you? Or was it that she actively did things that were non-loving to you?
Both.
Yeah.
Yeah, both. Yeah, I don't think I've actually talked about this part before with really anyone besides my closest friends, but I would occasionally, you know, I started to get into alcohol and tobacco later in high school. I had been sober, completely sober my whole high school experience until my junior year. And during this time, she took it really hard that I was experimenting with these things. For some reason, she wasn't able to accept this, you know, pretty natural development, or stage of a person growing up. And so I would come home after nights out to find, you know, very dramatic notes written on my bed from her, and her being closed off to me trying to address her about these notes. And so those were some of the active things that were done. And then there was just a more passive kind of interest in my life for the wrong reasons, perhaps more from a control perspective than from like a, I want to help my son, you know, navigate this world. So
a couple of things interesting from that. One, I was hesitant. You could even see it in my book even though I've thought about it a lot, I have been hesitant in the past to accept the value of psychedelic therapies over time, or just the value of psychedelics to change a perspective in a meaningful way, because I'm so used to what does Carlhart call it? Drug exceptionalism. I'm so used to people being like, you know, my drug is better than your drug kind of a thing. And so to champion their drug, they start explaining they can do more than it can. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, my relationship with a guy near me, Rick Barnett, who's went to school to become, once federal regulations relax, then he'll be able to prescribe psychedelics. And I've talked to him and I've learned a lot through him. And one of the things that they do, obviously, is that on one hand, like if you go through any sort of cognitive behavioral therapy, it's sort of saying, all right, let's stop and think and reroute those cognitive roadblocks that you have, those times you're being irrational or over emotional so that you can't actually think through a problem in a meaningful way. So like you were saying, you kind of had this experience where finally all those things you were thinking about and talking about the therapy, you're able to let in, you know, like that those could be. And then the other thing I always find interesting about it is that, and I've had this on MDMA, I remember reading Sam Harris's book and he expressed sort of the same thing where I finally realized there's some sort of emotional state or empathy state that's possible that I actually haven't felt before. So it's like a hack or an unlock. And I know that I got it through drugs, but also it's just possible in general. It's not only drugs that can unlock feeling empathy. So I'm extremely sympathetic now to when people tell me that they've had, and I'm noticing more and more that people are telling me that they've had these experiences, and I'm able to parse people saying, you know, just psychonauts, they were going to say it no matter what, versus someone like you who's explaining in a way that I can understand what happened. So it sounds like you were able to kind of sidestep mental blocks that you've had in your life, emotional and mental blocks, or irrational, overly rational frames of mind, and then also have a great deal of empathy for your mother, maybe more people than that you hadn't.
Yeah.
Really had before. And so that that maybe freed you up to do a lot of useful things.
Yeah. I think that the drug exceptionalism thing that Dr. Carlhart talks about, I totally understand that, because I being involved in the festival community somewhat, you know, there's a lot of people who swear by drugs, by their drug, think that everyone should do drugs. They say, you know, the world would be a better place if people just took some acid or something. And, you know, maybe it would, maybe it wouldn't, you know, and because I always just view it as like, if you have a great experience on a drug and after that drug wears off, you're not able to incorporate it into your life.
Right.
And what the fuck does it matter? You're just high feeling really good. And it doesn't matter. It's not making the world a better place. So I don't know. I think that there just needs to be a middle ground of between like no drugs and everyone do this drug. You know, it's like maybe not.
for sure. But yeah. Anyway, it's possible, and it definitely seemed to be at least a stepping stone in you making some progress. It sounds like a developmental time too when that stuff sort of happens. So maybe you have like a nice crossroads of experiences happening for you. You know, you're around people who are doing something meaningful, and that was interesting. You've been working on yourself in a lot of different ways. You had this experience where it's mind altering. So anyway, getting into your podcast, it's could be a nice segue to say again that still to this date, I've listened to several episodes now, and my favorite podcast episode of the EW podcast is the one with your mother.
Yeah.
And I wasn't sure. I didn't realize at the time exactly what it was that you guys had between you. You sort of discussed a little bit in the podcast, but there was some raw emotion in that episode that was like raw empathy. Like I could tell you were having this conversation with your mother, being so empathetic, but you could just, I don't know how to say this, that just there are words, there are concepts, and then there's tonality and emotion that just could shine through. And that episode that you did with your mother, there's something about it that's just like, there's something so meaningful in there. No matter what I feel like no matter what you talked about, it was going to be meaningful. So
thanks, man. I appreciate that.
Of course. I guess I should have let you respond to that.
No. It's all good. I appreciate that.
But that's not to say that other episodes of yours haven't been tremendous. So what I would like to talk about how you got into podcasting and how that has served a role in your life now.
Yeah. So starting off, the podcast was a way for me to continue learning and also feel as though I was doing something to help. You know, I didn't have many listeners. It's not a very big podcast, but it gave me a sense of purpose, which I think, you know, obviously everyone needs that sense. And now, I mean, my perspective on it has evolved quite significantly since I started it. You know, it started from a place of fear, combined with that curiosity, the fear of like, oh my God, we're all just walking around with traumas in our past that we've not dealt with. And I've come to realize that, you know, that's true for some people. Some people undoubtedly have traumas that they're not dealing with, but I think that the trauma thing maybe gets overstated a little bit these days, where people are like, oh, if you're upset, it's because you're traumatized. It's like, well, no, maybe they just need to find something in life that makes them feel like they have a purpose. Mm-hmm. So I've evolved in that sense, but I've also evolved in that the podcast is no longer just about mental health topics. I've since switched my perspective on the world a little bit and just evolving with age. I now just have people on that I'm interested in, people I just want to talk to. I've had a historian on to talk about the fall of Rome. I've had musicians on just to talk about creativity. So really now it's not even so much now about, oh man, I need to help people out. Now it's just like, I just like doing it. I like talking to people. It makes me a sharper person. And if people listen and find something useful, that's great. So I don't know. I think, yeah, it started as a way for me to address a fear that I had and has now become something that I like doing and want to get better at, you know?
Have you, when you started and you talked about, you know, you had a bent, like I had these traumatic instances, I felt shitty, and then I sort of am finding a purpose, and so I better help other people who are having that kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Was that in earnest? I mean, did you totally believe that, or did you feel like maybe, well, I should end the question there.
No. What were you going to say? Or maybe, because I'm curious.
Or maybe what... not. No. No. I'll relay it back to myself again. I'm not trying to talk about myself. I just, it's the most fair thing to do. When I started a podcast, I thought I needed to help people too. But it turns out, looking back on it, I had, maybe didn't really know how to articulate it, but I had different aspirations also. It wasn't just like, you know, when I looked at, okay, who's listening to the podcast now? I wasn't thinking at first, I wonder how many people I helped. I wonder how many people this served. I wonder how it was like, I wonder how many people heard my ideas and liked them.
Yeah.
That kind of a thing. And I'm wondering if you've had a progression like that, where you've become more and more honest and valued in your work.
Yeah. I appreciate you giving me your experience, because I didn't know, I really didn't know how to articulate what you just said. I appreciate the multiple choice option.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And you could choose other.
Yeah. No, but I think that's extremely accurate. Like I was more concerned about listenership than I was about, are people using the ideas to improve their life? I think that's super accurate. And I never really thought about it like that, but yeah, that definitely played a part in it. And I think that now, so, okay, that played a part in it because in a way I felt as though I was entering a space that maybe I didn't belong in. So I wanted validation from a growing listenership to know that I was doing the right thing.
Oh, really well said. Yep.
Yeah. So I no experience in mental health besides my own, no, you know, study or anything. And so I'm interviewing like a therapist, I'm interviewing, you know, whoever. And there's this imposter syndrome that goes with that. And also a pressure that I was putting on myself to sound like I knew what I was talking about. And so, yeah, I was looking at the viewership as a sort of validation for me to feel better about what I was doing, which I've definitely gotten over. Yeah. Well, for the most part, gotten over.
Well, because it sounds, even when you were just talking about how you started, you said it with the caveat right away. Like, I wanted to talk about people's traumas. It's true for some people, but, you know, and you're very much more clear and seemingly proud of the subsequent statements. Like, I just kind of like engaging with the world. Mm-hmm. And it's cool because you can, you know, if you're anything like me, then it gives you, a podcast gives you an excuse to talk in maybe an intellectual or interesting way, long form, with people you just wouldn't have those conversations with otherwise.
Nailed it. Yeah, that's exactly right. So in the beginning, I was definitely looking at it as I'm going to make a name for myself. I'm going to help all these people. People are going to respect me because I'm doing this. And now, since opening up the conversations and accepting my limitations in a way, I've now just, it gets me geeked out to just talk to like someone I'm reading, someone whose book I read, and they're open to talking to me. It's like, whoa, cool. I would probably never be talking to this person otherwise. And I think, yeah, you nailed it on the head there.
If you enjoyed the Social Exchange podcast and you currently don't contribute to the show, maybe you're thinking, yeah, I like you, but I don't give you my money like you. Let me tell you two ways that you can make a contribution at no cost. For one, take a minute, subscribe to the podcast, and then rate us on your preferred podcast app. Please do this. A lot of you listen. Tons of listens. Or I'm talking thousands of listens to each episode versus like 40 reviews on the Apple podcast player. We need some of those reviews, baby. We need to make our ranks in the algorithm. Another thing you can do is subscribe to our YouTube channel. We're very new at doing YouTube in a proper way. We're probably still not doing it in a proper way. But we could use some subscribers on YouTube. And of course, in return, we must continue to offer new, good YouTube content, which we'll continue to do. And so, if you can do that, we're grateful for that. And at the same time, our show is supported solely by listener contributions. If you'd like to make a donation, then you can very easily do so at PayPal, which there's a link in the show notes, or at our Patreon page, which is patreon.com/thesocialexchange. For as little as $2, you'll be doing a lot to support our work, and you'll receive exclusive Patreon content, as well as early access to all regularly scheduled episodes. Again, to drop us a tip, visit patreon.com/thesocialexchange. And as is custom, I want to thank all of our new Patreon subscribers. Thank you so much to Stephen Rabinowitz, Jesse Dunleavy, Andrew Tatarski, Dean Lemire, Christy McPherson, Nuncio De Martino, Susan Lennon, James Stacks, Chris L., Leon Nahufahu, Sherry Chandler, Didi Stout, Chris Hanlon, Henri Pompel, Carter Vermont, Rick Barnett, Ann M. Earl, Inigo, John, Layla, Mary Kay Villaverde, Nancy Michelle, Sean Holt, Regina Ferguson, Timmy Tucker, Christian, Kathleen Cochran, Marjorie Israel, Diane T., Trevor, and my family members who still contribute and support the show, Susan Matthew, Linda Rhodes, and Thomas Rhodes. Thank you to all who have contributed to the podcast so far. If you'd like to join this list, then just visit patreon.com/thesocialexchange. Now back to the show.
What are some of your favorite episodes to date?
Today, I really like ours. It's one of my favorites, nice. One of my most listened to, for sure.
I love talking with you on that one, too.
Yeah, that was a great one. Some other good ones. I had a good one with my friends, Evan, Casey, and Marbs, where we talked about, it was right as the pandemic was starting, and we were talking about silver linings from the pandemic. I had this woman on, Barbara Arrowsmith Young, who had some serious learning difficulties growing up, and she was able to create she wasn't able to read an analog clock. She couldn't interpret the symbols and what the big hand and little hand meant. She just, you know, could not do it. And she was able to come up with a series of training exercises where she addressed all of her learning difficulties, and now has programs for schools, has her own school where she's helping kids with learning difficulties.
So I missed this one.
Yeah. It's a really good book too. It's called The Woman Who Changed Her Brain. The Woman Who Changed Your Brain. And that one was still one of my favorites. And I'd recommend that one. And I have a couple, I'm not sure when this one will come out, but two that are coming out that I'm really excited about. One with our mutual contact, Anthony Mangabasco, which I'm stoked about.
Looking forward to that.
Yeah. And another with the author and chess grandmaster, Jonathan Rosen. I don't know if you're familiar with him at all, but yeah, he wrote a book called The Moves of Life, The Moves That Matter, A Chess Grandmaster on the Game of Life.
Okay, was he on, what's his name, the MIT guy? The robotics, that has Lex Friedman's podcast?
Lex Friedman? I don't know.
Anyway.
He might have been. He's really interesting guy. He's like in the Game B world a little bit, where he has an organization called Perspectiva that's a conglomeration of thinkers, artists, and they're all trying to solve Game B type questions.
Let's talk about what Game B means for people who don't know.
Yeah. So it's basically an alternative to the current way society is structured. So they look at it as we're in Game A right now, and there are clearly things that aren't working about it. So how can we develop a society that will better serve everyone? So that's kind of how I would interpret it. Do you have a different interpretation of it?
No, that's the trick. But it gets me thinking about something that we haven't talked about on this podcast yet, which is that we sort of met that way. I think our heads are in that space with in the Unity movement. Which it wasn't, I'll let you maybe explain a little bit about it, but I don't know that it's perfect. It was sort of done in rush order, but it's Brett Weinstein's brainchild. Mm-hmm. And it was really like a last minute attempt to say, listen, I've been thinking about this way that we could have governance of our country and keep the Constitution intact and keep our rights, you know, preserve our rights and preserve the things we all value, but it would go differently than it currently is. It would help our divide. Mm-hmm. And I got super interested in this, and apparently you did too.
Yeah, me too.
By trying to push out some content for them. Will you talk about that and how you found it? And maybe you could do a little better description than what I did.
Yeah, no, I think you did a good job describing it. I mean, it was, I don't know if you said the 2020 presidential election specifically, but it was an attempt to get a third option, that a bipartisan third option on the ticket, to steer us from, you know, two bad choices, basically. So, I saw him talk about it first on the Joe Rogan Experience sometime in that summer, and just the idea of someone actually doing something. You know, it was driving me crazy the fact that we had several good options in the Democratic primary. You know, Tulsi Gabbard and Andrew Yang and Bernie were all people who actually care about people and are making some sense. You know, you can agree or disagree and call Bernie a communist or whatever, but yep, his heart is in the right place. He actually wants to solve things. And I would believe that he would be less willing to, or less likely to govern ideologically and more willing to do what is necessary. So I don't know. It was just very invigorating to me to know that I could be involved potentially with something that would bring more, what's the right word? Reasonable governance to our country. And so, yeah, I signed up for the volunteer network. And that's where we met in the Unity Now podcast, which is still going on. I have last week, I've stepped away from my involvement, but still watching. So
I have a cult detection kit that I use for myself, which I realized it runs parallel to startup detection kits, which I should have also. But I signed up for volunteering. I thought, all right, well, let's see. Actually, it was somewhat, I don't remember how it worked, but somehow I got in touch with somebody who said, oh, you should sign up here and then we could do something with your podcast. And I signed up, and right as I put my name on, it was like 5 minutes later, someone said, hey, well, how would you like to help? Here's things you could do. Great to have you aboard. It's like, hey, wait a minute. Why was that, you know, why was that so easy? But it was just a grassroots movement of people who were trying to figure out some way to, as you say, there's a trillion. If we really cared about the best candidate running for president, it's like someone else said this. It should be like, how does it say? It's like a slam dunk competition where there's so many smart, amazing people that it should be one candidate after another. And then next one's, oh my God, whoa.
Right.
And, you know, just holy shit, you're so smart. You know, you have the greatest ideas. They should all be people. Andrew Yang shouldn't surprise us, you know.
No.
Like that shouldn't. So I've always been sympathetic to the idea of creating some new way of establishing the governance in the first place, which I think is what was happening in that space.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of looking at it, that these types of people like Andrew Yang shouldn't be surprising. And I think it just speaks to the lack of ideas. Like Biden wasn't running on any, you know, sexy or interesting ideas. He was just, we're going to go back to normal. Things are going to be normal. And so I don't know. It's just the ultimate bummer that we live in this place where so much is possible. There's so many smart people. Technology opens up so many new doors, and we just have a, you know, what, 75-year-old dude saying things are just going to go back to how they're. Yeah. Things are going to go back to how they were 4 years ago. It's like,
right.
Thanks.
So, yeah. Yeah. do you think a lot about politics?
No.
more so since you started with that project?
This is maybe interesting, is that I was an apolitical Democrat for most of my life, where I didn't really look into things, didn't care too much until Trump was elected. And then my interest, you know, increased a little bit in what was going on. And I think last year in particular, particularly after the George Floyd killing, I became way more critical of what was being said by either party, and way more skeptical. And so I became hyper interested in politics up until the election. And then after the election, I like took this month-long break, and I've kind of settled into this place of not apathy or agnosticism, but limited energy input. You know, I don't want to be the guy that's like tied to the news or knows every story. And I'm glad that there's people that exist, like the Rising Crew, Crystal Ball and Sagar and Genty. It's good that they're absorbing every story, but that's not for me. I don't know. I think for most of us, it's just about finding a healthy balance of knowing what's going on. How does it affect you? What do you believe in? And not letting it dominate your life. Cause I was having a hard time sleeping last year, you know, during the summer and the fall, where it was like, are we headed to doomsday? Like, it feels like things are just going to, like, are we going to nuke each other? Are we about to nuke Portland or something? Like, what is going on? And so I was running through all these doomsday scenarios all the time, stuck to the news, stuck to every story.
And I was picturing Trump, somebody saying, are we going to nuke Portland? And like, per capita, can you do that?
Yeah, for sure. Seriously. Yeah. So yeah, I right now I'm just trying, I'm still working on it. You know, I go in and out of ignorance and too much. So I think it's just finding a healthy balance. Yeah.
Well, good on you, man. And so you seem like a creator more than a person who likes to stew on problems. Or yes. At least that's what you've thrived on.
No, I'm glad you said that, because that is that's kind of my current internal battle right now that I'm having, where there's so many intellectual people, you among them, like people who are really good at critically thinking, and your podcast has been a great source of example setting for me, I guess, of like how to use first principles, how to really dissect a problem to its very core. What, you know, instead of just asking surface level questions, really getting in deep and really understanding things. And I don't know, I'm having this internal battle right now, which I think is healthy, of like, are you striving to be this intellectual powerhouse, or is there another way that you can, you know, contribute to the conversation? And so right now I'm trying to find this space of doing the creative thing, which I much prefer to thinking about a problem all day and trying to get to the bottom of it. I'd rather, you know, create a video or an animation to help spread the word about something that I believe in. So it's kind of like where I am right now. Are you an intellectual, or are you just a creative guy? Like, how can you exist here? So
that's something that Stanton Beale has taught me, that, I always like to talk philosophy with him, but because I thought that he liked that, but he just sort of sees the world the way he's able to see it without much fanfare, I guess you might say. And he likes to do things practically, like, all right, I see the problems, I'm going to do something about it now. So I would talk, you know, philosophy all day with him, and he'd be like, who the fucking cares? And I'm like, okay, great. You could sit around talking about this, but, you know, all the problems have just happened a bunch of times while we were talking about it. So it's good, always good, of course, to get your brain wrapped around something then in the right way and get adjusted.
Yeah. But yeah, I think being, sorry to cut you off, but I just wanted to input that. I think that's one of the things that I maybe find interesting about your podcast with Dr. Peel, Sundays with Stories, right?
Yeah, thank you.
I think that's one of the things that I find interesting about it, and maybe didn't realize that that was what I found interesting about it, but is I think you guys make a interesting team of Stanton talking from his experience and research, and you kind of getting more philosophical with the question. And it's a good combination, I think.
Oh, you hit it on the head, man. So that one doesn't have a ton of viewership or listenership yet, but
it's good stuff, man. I like how you get into current events. Like the Jordan Peterson thing was really interesting. I was very sympathetic to his situation. I was like, oh man, get off the drugs, Jordan, I'm rooting for you. And after listening to yours, it's like, well, it's interesting way to think about it. So yeah, I appreciate what you guys are doing there.
Oh, thanks, man. But back to you. You can't fool me. So where do you see the podcast going? And I guess just let's call the whole thing journalism, because I was, when I started doing this show a long time ago, before, this is something that probably isn't even around anymore. A guy who, his name is David Mindich. He's a professor of journalism at Temple now. I was interviewing him, and I said something during the interview like, I want to do journalism at some point. He's like, what do you think you're doing now? And so he was sort of intuiting at that time, which is before that real big boom of technology where everyone's doing something, that if you're asking questions and you're putting it out there and you're trying to get information across to other people, then you're doing journalism. So let's preface it that way. What's your future look like for your journalism?
So that's something I'm pondering. You know, there are so many smart people out there interviewing so many other smart people and getting so many interesting ideas out to the world, that my question I've been asking myself is, do you really need to waste your energy trying to be as smart as everyone and doing the same thing? So I'm kind of in the space of like doing less podcasts, doing them about specifically ideas that really interest me, and then creating more content around that idea. So that's actually something that I mentioned I'm doing with your book. Once I can find a damn second to finish up.
Oh, yeah. Understood.
Just to give a little overview of what that will be is, I'm almost done with basically laying out all the scenes. I just need to put movement and things to it, but, it's going to be an animation style review of Outgrowing Addiction, which I hope to do for more books. So the ideal situation would be maybe once a month, have a guest on who's written a book, read the book, talk to the guest, then come up with clips and also the animation style review of the book to
so cool.
spread the message. So it's, I think that there's this opening for people to exist where they are kind of an intermediary between these higher levels of thought and the rest of society. Like, not everyone wants to sit down and listen to Lex Fridman and Elon Musk talk about, you know, whatever it is they talk about.
Right.
But there could be interesting things that could be boiled down into a 4-minute entertaining sort of animation or video. So that's kind of the space I think I want to put myself in, is this guy who's listening to these sorts of things, but then providing a way for the general public to access in an easier way.
That just hits all your skills, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think so. So
that's crazy. So I'm just realizing that how I've asked you, there's a behind the scenes, I've asked you before if you would want to collaborate in the future.
Yeah.
And I can't quite tell exactly why. Like, I couldn't even think of the project that we would do, but it would be really cool to collaborate with you. And I think be really valuable. And I'm just realizing now that I'm trying not to besmirch myself by saying this. I'm not saying this in a negative way, but the way that I put information out there is I read or hear or understand someone's point of view so deeply, and then I maybe get troubled that other people aren't understanding it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the same thing when I have a point of view, it's really hard to implement it because I think deeply and critically about things. It's sometimes mm-hmm. I have trouble making it practical. So the mm-hmm. way that I make all those things practical is by sitting down, talking it out, the way, you know, talking to people about their own ideas, the way that I understand them, so that people mm-hmm. who are listening can get it. And then that, you know, push the information out that way, or
write
a book about it or whatever. Yep. And that's a little selfish because it's like, it's really cathartic for me because I had to get that out there. And that's the way that I do it. I try to be a good listener all the while. You know, I try not too much to make podcasts about me, but here I am in this one talking about myself.
No, this is good. This builds.
You seem to be, and I've always thought this, and I've always enjoyed your style of interviewing. You put the person you're interviewing way out front, sort of like I'm a musician. So I know, you know, and when you're doing mixes, then you put vocals out front.
Mm-hmm.
You put your interviewee out front, and you're smart. And you could hang with all, I mean, you could get into the web of intellectualness, but it seems like you prefer to let people speak and give them opportunities to speak in a forum maybe they wouldn't have otherwise been able to.
Yeah.
You're a listener and you're humble.
I appreciate that. I definitely appreciate that, because that has been the goal, is to, I don't know, maybe there's part of fear of sounding stupid that contributes to that, which might be something I should address. But there's also just a genuine acknowledgement of my own limitations and my own, you know, time is a finite resource. Every day we only have so much time. I can only focus on so many things. This person that I'm bringing in has spent way more time than me on this topic. There's nothing I can tell them that is probably going to be new, unless it's from my own experience. You know, I'm not going to have Zach Rhodes or Stan Peel on and teach them something fundamental about addiction. I can tell them about my experience and relate that to them. But I think I read a really good quote yesterday. So this is actually that book I mentioned by Jonathan Rosen. All right. Yeah. So this really resonated with me last night reading. It's, the challenge is that to have proper curiosity about anything, you need to know at least something, so that the question of what you don't know carries some value.
Yeah.
So it's like I come into these conversations having some base level knowledge about what we're going to talk to. And then the goal is to have enough knowledge beforehand that the questions you ask are genuine and actually matter. So I'm not asking them something I could just Google, where it's like, I want to know enough to be curious, but I don't want to devote so much time to this thing to become an expert. That's kind of where I'm at. Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's so valuable. And talk about practical. So you're saying like you have something to offer. So this is not just like intellectual, like masturbation or something. You actually have something to offer, that there's a skill that you've honed that you can funnel all this stuff into and put it out there. And it's like valuable to the masses. It could be. Mm-hmm. So you taking keynotes from people's ideas and putting them into digestible, understandable videos, you're intelligent enough to understand it, you may or may not want to like hang in the, you know, in the forefront of that debate or whatever it is, of that piece of knowledge. But to some level, you're like, well, what am I going to have experts on? And I'm going to get so well versed in every single one.
Yeah.
Like how long would that take? And so you are trying to practically figure out a system for generating good news out of it.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like, does the world really need me to spend all my spare time learning about a topic and stressing myself out when I, you know, am not able to keep up with someone? Or is it more valuable to use the skills I already have and just become a sort of amplifier for good ideas? And I think that's what I want to be. Yeah.
Yeah. I love it, man. So, I was telling, someone, here's another problem I have that maybe help me sort out. Did you know that actually I was getting wholesale therapy from you right now? I'm, in line with the first principle thing. Like I've always cheated. I don't know. You think of it like cut the line or something. And you also mentioned imposter syndrome. So let me give an example. I'm a musician. I'm a professional musician, piano, singer, play sax and drums. And I was, do you play music?
Yeah, play some guitar.
All right. So, you know, well, you'll have something similar on guitar, but on piano especially, you can play, you can play different intervals, different hand positions for different chords. And so I remember being young and I was taking piano lessons. And so someone would say, like, play a C chord, and I would play, instead of C, E, G sequentially, I would mix up the notes so that my hand could be, it's just so that I could go to the next chord with ease, which is what you do. But you're taught eventually to do that. And I was told, no, you, that's something you can do, but you just want to play it straight. And then eventually, like as you get more, and I always have always thought about every topic, like why would I have to wait? That's not how you do it with anything. Like I think about a kid learning a language and that's not how it works. You don't, if they learn a word or learn a concept or learn how to describe something, you don't say like, no, that's a 12th grade thing to think and explore and understand. So I've always been that way. So I'm trying to figure out what it is. I'm still growing too. So I'm trying to figure out what it is that, that I can use. That's what I do with everything. Like I'm not actually an addiction expert. I'm a fake one, but I've studied it so hard and learned so much about it that I know all of the addiction experts, the most famous ones in the world. And I speak at the conferences and I talk about imposter syndrome. I'm not really a musician, but I am because I play concerts and get paid to do it. And I'm not really a journalist, but I am because I make money putting out journalism.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you have found that sort of same sort of niche for yourself. And I wonder, have you encountered people in your wake, I guess you'd say, in like people younger than you or less experienced than you who want to do something similar? And have you had any good advice for them? Likewise, have you experienced anybody who's further along in what you're trying to do or like what I'm trying to do? And have you gotten any good advice from people like that? And by the way, sorry that sometimes I feel like if I just give a shorthand explanation of something that maybe you and I understand, that a bigger audience won't know what I'm even talking about. So I felt compelled to just give a little explanation there.
No, I like it. I'm glad you did. It makes sense. And just to make sure I have it. So basically you're saying that whenever you approach a topic or something, you just dive in and you learn. You don't necessarily see the point in starting at the most basic level entry point. You want to just dive in and absorb what you absorb and grow up from there, as opposed to.
And that's, I think, a skill that I've been able to actually share with the world because I can do that. I'm able to then share it. And that's part of my bent, is that I take a skill, do it. And then it's always something that I try to give value to other people because I've done it. I'm juxtaposing that with you having sort of done the same thing.
Gotcha.
In that you could hang intellectually in a conversation, but maybe instead of trying to hang intellectually, you will actually do something productive with the conversation, which is to be a great listener and reflector, and then also take the information, bundle it in a digestible way.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I haven't had any, I'm trying to think, have I? No, I haven't had anybody seek my advice on the matter yet. Maybe and talk again in 5 years and see if that changes. But
I am now. So that counts.
Yeah. And I think that the, how I came to this, so you're kind of, there's you and one other person are in a similar realm of doing things in a similar way that I want to do them. You're more, you have more of an expertise, I think, but you still, explore a wide range of topics on your show. It's not like you're an addiction show. Like you're just, let's talk about ideas show. So that, I mean, we've had some long conversations and I've absorbed a lot of what you said about your own experience and took that to heart. And there's also another friend, Eamon Armstrong, who runs a podcast called Life is a Festival. And he has a little more, his expertise is like festivals and psychedelic research, psychedelic therapy. But he also very much is open to having conversations across a wide variety of topics. So I've always just looked at kind of you two guys, honestly, as like being an example for how curiosity can get you through this. And then also comedians to me right now like the people who are really setting the bar of this type of medium. Like people like Joe Rogan is a great example, Tim Dillon even, people who have a comedic background. There's no reason Joe Rogan should be able to talk to like a Egyptian archaeologist,
but
he can do it because he's just as curious about it. And so he has a base level of knowledge about the subject. Maybe he's read the book of the guest or watched a documentary and he's curious about the world, and that's enough to create an interesting conversation. So it's real, like comedians for me have been huge in accepting that you don't need to be the expert to have interesting conversations.
I'm going full Lex Friedman on you, I guess, but, but are you afraid of death? No, I'm just kidding. the comedians have like the thing I'm explaining that I can do is I can become an expert in something that I'm sufficiently interested in such a short amount of time that if I am interested in it and I know other people are interested in it, give me a year or two and I will give you the gist of whatever it is in a way that people who are experts at it would agree with. So that's a skill. And I try to do that all the time.
Yeah.
You have a skill of making things digestible so that like the masses could understand it. Like anyone could go to an animated video that breaks down more complex concepts. And so that's a great skill that you have that takes many more dimensions than just like, you don't just regurgitate something. It's like you artistically do it. Comedians have the skill of it seems like comedians are so interested in just everything social because what they're seeing is, did we talk about this last time?
No, I don't think so.
The what is water? Oh my God, I forget his name. David Foster Wallace gave this speech, and he started off with a parable where two young fish were swimming.
There are these two young fish swimming along, and they happen to meet an older fish swimming the other way, who nods at them and says, "Morning, boys, how's the water?" And the two young fish swim on for a bit, and then eventually one of them looks over at the other and goes, "What the hell is water?"
Yeah,
and I feel like comedians are always seeing the water. You know, they're always looking at it and they're saying, "We're all idiots." And then so they have this like great artistic way of delivering information out to other people. What do you think comes first? The ability, you know, the skill or the ability to do that, or the curiosity?
That's a great question. And again, so I pretty much believe pretty universally that any skill can be developed with the right amount of interest and energy. You know, it just has to take interest and energy equals skill. But, you know, you look at someone like Joe Rogan, who we just brought up, who has made millions of dollars off of just being curious. Like, if you go back and watch his early episodes, they're horrible. They're so bad. And he clearly has developed that skill. So I think that there's like a base level of curiosity, of like interest in the world that you have to have. And even then it could probably be developed still. So for me, you know, when I was depressed, there was none of that interest or curiosity. Like I was never the guy at a function or an event asking someone questions to get to know them. I admit that I had a very like surface level relationship with most people because I wasn't very curious about who they were or what was going on. And after coming out of that, I think curiosity started to develop more and more in me. So I don't know. I think someone like Tim Dillon, who is always just seems to be seeing what is going on in a very real way and able to, I don't know, he just has this knack for being able to, you know, call a spade that whenever maybe everyone else is seeing a diamond or a club and he's like, wait, no, what are you guys talking about? This is a fucking spade. I don't know. It's hard to say that he doesn't have some sort of natural ability, but I don't know.
Okay. I won't divert too much, but I do listen to his podcast regularly.
Yeah, I actually was just listening to it a little before we got on.
His most recent episode?
Yeah, with Anna Kachian.
Oh, okay. So the one before that is what I was thinking of, where he makes me think about things I don't want to think about because he can make them funny. Mm. And that's such a freaking, such a gift.
Maybe what was it? Do you remember?
Yeah, I'm going to try. It was so well done. Like, people think of him as just like careless. Mm-hmm. Which in a way he sort of is, but he's also so careful.
Right.
So he was talking about, so the fact that I had laughed before this, this information is not funny, but it was, there was a murder that was caught on someone's door cam, you know, the doorbell ring, whatever it's called. And he was describing that his producer, Ben, had him watch the thing. He not knowing that that's what it was. He's like, what the hell? And then he described it in detail. And he described that the person at the end shot this person and was said just before he shot them that he's like, you should have kept your mouth shut. And so he was describing this and he kept saying over and over again, it's like, if you are disturbed by this, just fast forward 5 minutes. It's not, I promise it'll get better. This is on my mind, blah, blah, blah. And he kept bringing that up, said this stuff at the end. He's like, so deeply disturbed. And it's like, this thing shouldn't have ever happened. It's disgusting. But?
Yeah.
And so he just creates that. He made you on his side, right? You're on his good side because he's saying the right things. Mm-hmm. So you're with them all the way. And then he said, and then like, what could possibly come after? But, and he just holds that pause for so long. And then he just makes it, he could do so much for that space.
Dude, yeah. was that the end of the story? So I don't want to cut
you off. I won't even go in because I'll ruin the joke after that because he did it so amazingly. But yeah.
I feel compelled to just mention another similar, in the one I just watched, the most recent one as of today, he was talking about David Hogg. Do you know David Hogg?
Yeah, yeah.
The Parkland survivor. Mm-hmm. And he was like,
scared.
this is a trigger warning for sure. But he was like, you're not a victim. You survived a school shooting. Like, you came out of there. Right. You should be happy to survive. Like, you can't call yourself a victim anymore. You're a victim when you go through it, but you lived. Like, shut up, kid.
Okay. And so, you know, what's crazy is that. Oh, so I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say it makes you, it's like what you said, where he makes you think about something where you're like, ooh.
Yeah, I would never have thought that. Never have said that. Yeah. I don't want to be on your side. How did you get me on? It's like when you're watching The Sopranos or something and you're on Tony Soprano's side, even though he kills a bunch of people or something like that.
Yeah, for sure.
I feel like that's the space that Louis C.K. was trying to joke about that people had so much pushback against him for.
Yeah.
If you remember that.
Yeah,
he was trying to work out his material about a joke like that, but he couldn't quite land it. It just wasn't quite that funny yet. I mean, people in that thing. And then he got called out anyway.
Yeah, I feel like that kind of stuff is like, if there's anything that saves us from ourselves, it's going to be comedians starting it, I feel like, because they're the ones who are, you know, calling out both sides. And if you're listening, you realize just how stupid all the fighting that goes on in our country is, and that we just need to like chill out and enjoy life. So I don't know. I'm thankful we have comedians like those, and Andrew Schultz, of course, and you know, the rest.
So have you spoken to any comedians on your podcast?
No, but I would love to. I would love to. Have you?
No, but again, I want to. It's funny that you mentioned all that, because that's the lane I wanted to start going down, is like, I would love to have Mark Norman on, for instance.
Oh my God. He's my favorite right now, dude. He's so good.
Just people who don't mind, people who are funny, but don't mind just talking about the craft of their craft.
Yeah.
The things that I think about can get so dark. Like, I try not to get in a dark place myself, but yeah, I mean, the stuff going on in the world is tough to parse, and it gets so emotionally invested. And I feel like comedy gives you an excuse to think those things, but in a lighter way.
Yeah,
Those guys are just phenomenal at living in that space.
Yeah, I agree. And it's hard to be, I don't know. It's hard to, maybe even impossible to be like a alt-right person or be an Antifa person and have comedy. Like, what are you going to joke about? You know, it's not going to be funny. And I feel like comedians just occupy that middle space so well. And it's,
right.
All
right. So maybe it should be a joint effort. We should maybe start getting comedians to talk.
Yeah. I'm down, man. That'd be so cool.
That's our new project. Right. Just that, I don't know about you, but I could never be a comedian. It's cool to interview them.
The only person that thinks I'm funny is my girlfriend.
Right. And she was just trying to make it feel nice. Yeah. Just kidding. So the last thing I'll ask before I'd love you to plug any and everything is, do you feel pressured to get conversations done in a time frame and have specific content when you're interviewing people? I ask because your interviews seem to flow really naturally. Like, you have the key points in front of you and on hand, but your podcast seemed to flow really naturally and let the speaker be the speaker. I don't know if it's some sort of control issue, but I tried. It's like I'm in a rush or some time urgency, yet I never finish in a reasonable amount of time. So I always feel like I'm rushed and like, oh, I'm grasping for something. Yeah. And this conversation with you has been an experiment a little bit in allowing myself, the last two conversations, in allowing myself to just take it in a direction that maybe has nothing to do with why I asked you to be on. And seeing what that's like. So anyway, have you played around with that, or have you been caught up in that, or how do you think about that sort of cadence thing?
Yeah, the cadence thing is interesting, because there's many times where I feel I've shared that same feeling of being rushed and never having been fully into it. Kind of trying to be one step ahead of it instead of letting it just occur, where it's, I don't know. I think the best conversations I've had, and the last two we've done, have been really fun. I've had a great time. So yeah. But I think the best conversations I've had have been that's an interesting question. I mean, I feel like the best ones that I've had have always happened because in some way I've let the other person lead the dance. You know, like, these are very much like a dance, and one person has to lead and the other one person is kind of following. And I think whenever I'm trying to lead it, it's whenever I leave feeling really dissatisfied with it. But if I let the other person take it where they want to take it, you know, Joe Rogan, again, sorry to just be,
he's a great example for a lot of things.
Gobbling on him, but he does it so well. He's like, he is really good at not feeling confined by the topic that was agreed upon, and if the guest brings up something, to let it go down the tangent and then come back. And I feel like the best ones I've had are where I've allowed that to happen and not viewed as the conversation as needing to happen within a confined, narrow scope of interest, you know? So
how do you have a formula for achieving that? So like, if I have, let's say I had Jordan Peterson on tomorrow, I would feel like I need to figure out how to do this in a way that I'm not wasting his time. So I wouldn't then feel free to make the conversation the way that I know it would be the best conversation, ironically. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting point. And I think about like, I feel like I've done a really good job of this with my, a couple of recent ones I've had. There was one I recently did where I left it feeling super dissatisfied. I won't mention which one it was, but the two that I mentioned earlier, Anthony Magnabosco and Jonathan Rosen, when I interviewed them, I came in prepared with specific things I wanted to talk about, but there was already an acknowledgement beforehand of letting it flow in some way. And I don't know, it's hard to say what the formula is. It's just more so the mindset going in and sitting down. Like the one that I mentioned that was not good, I definitely sat down feeling like, okay, I have to talk about these points. We have to hit these things. They have limited time. We only have an hour and I have to make sure we stay on track. And the other two, Jonathan Rosen and Anthony Magnabosco, I just had a couple major things that I wanted to talk about. And there was almost, it was almost a way, a nod to you and just like being like, okay, take your time with each idea, listen to what they're saying, you know, be present for what they're saying and they will bring up something interesting to talk about. You know, you don't need to be the one with all these prepared questions necessarily. You just have to be present and actually listening to them and they will give you something to ask about, you know, like, what do you mean by this? What do you think? I don't know. It's
you just sounds like you'd be a good clinician. Like that's sort of the formula. I've noticed that, like, the more I hone my own clinical skills in listening to people talk about their issues, like I'm not, even though I'm sort of, there's a weird hierarchy there when someone comes to see you for professional help, but where you're a little bit on top and you're supposed to lead something, but at the same time it's like, well, I can't, it's your experience, so you're gonna have to figure it out, but I can help that. I feel like that's what interviewing is, like great interviewing is. Larry King was a good example of someone who did that.
For sure. Yeah, I agree. He was great. Tim Ferriss does a pretty good job of that too. He comes in with very prepared questions, a lot of structure to what he wants to talk about, but I always feel like he's super present in what his guest is saying and ready to chase them down whatever rabbit hole they want to go, which I think is the best way to do it.
Well, thank you for running with me down every rabbit hole in the car for us today.
Yeah, it was fun.
Eric, please plug any and everything that you're working on right now or maybe working on in the future.
Yeah. So you can visit my site, ericwhite.com. There's no I in white. So it's ericwhite.com. You can also go to theewpodcast.com and that'll redirect. The EW podcast is available on YouTube, Spotify, Apple, pretty much everywhere. And yeah, on social media, the Eric White formula with no I also is where you'll find me. I'm on Instagram and Twitter mostly. And the main thing coming up, like I mentioned before, is going to be this focus on YouTube stuff. So that would be probably where I would encourage people to go find me if they want to stay up to date, because that's where the more interesting things will be happening this year. So yeah, working on that. And there's, yeah, that's pretty much it right now. But
right on, man. Thanks so much for talking to me again and, you know, doing like a sort of a rerun through everything we talked about. It was great talking to you and I hope you keep up the amazing work.
Thanks, brother. You too, man. Appreciate it.
Take care.